From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan.
And a very warm welcome aboard the pirate ship, the Reeve Gauche, and to the Captain Table podcast. I'm Giles Morgan. I'm not actually a captain or a pirate, but a vague ancestor of my family, Captain Henry Morgan, was one. And his family all came from Wales as well. So there we are. This is a romp of a podcast where each week I simply ask my special guests to share their own personal memories of being a sports fan and how that passion has affected and shaped their own lives. My guest this week is former Great Britain and England Rugby League and Rugby Union player, Jason Robinson. As a player, it was his astonishing speed and fast feet that simply ripped apart defences and earned him the nickname Billy Whiz. Over a 20-year career, he has won nearly everything there is to win in both codes of the game. Challenge Cups, Super Leagues, Grand Slams, and most memorably, scoring a crucial try in England's World Cup win over Australia in 2003. A father of seven children, he is now an ambassador for the Rugby League World Cup, a distinguished media pundit and businessman, and an all-round top bloke. Jason, a very warm welcome to the Captain's Table. Pull up a chair and make yourself at home.
Thank you very much, Mr. Giles.
Well, I think it's the captain, but I'll let you off. We're on a pirate ship, so first things first, I need to get you a drink. And it means we've only got rum on board. So what will you have? Will you have a mojito? A rum and coke, a dark and stormy, or the captain's secret coconut and pineapple mocktail?
Well, I'm definitely not going to go for the mocktail. So I think I think we're straight rum.
Okay, I'll just ask the steward. Steward, if you could get, which one was it?
Straight rum.
A straight rum. Yeah, we'll have that straight down. Two of those. Right, ice?
I'll have ice as well, yeah.
He's got ice, good. Okay, so it really is wonderful to have you on board this boat of mine, the Reeve Gauche. You've played sport all over the world. You've been lucky to be involved in sport, but it would have started for all of us as being a fan. What was your earliest memory of being as a young lad of being a fan?
So for me, growing up in Leeds, I was brought up in all the probably the most deprived areas in Leeds, and nobody in my family liked sport. Nobody, no uncle, no father. I never knew my father, but nobody really pushed me down that route in my family. So my earliest memories of being a fan is when I joined a rugby team, you know, and all of a sudden I was introduced to sport, and a lot of my mates used to love different sports. And whilst I ended up playing rugby at really high level, I used to love all sports. And I can remember going down to Ellen Road when I was a young lad and going down with my mates. And Ellen Road, great history, you know, some amazing players over the years. And it was around the time where Vinnie Jones was there. If you went into any barbers in Leeds during that period, on the wall, it would be short back and sides, you know, black crew cut, whatever it is, and then there'd be a Vinnie Jones, and everybody would have the V just shaved into the back of the head. And Vinnie Jones and Leeds at that time were huge.
And so was Vinnie the first sort of athlete that you could identify with, that he was bigger than just the football he played, but what he meant for the people of Leeds growing up?
Yeah, I think at that time he was just... It was just, I think everybody could relate to him. Leeds was kind of working class. It was a real character. He used to get stuck in and, you know, he used to be going, Vinny, 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 Vinny. And I can remember just being in the cop with my mates. Now, it was an amazing experience, but at the same time, it probably wasn't the best place for a young black lad to be in the cop, because all of a sudden, you know, they'd score a goal, and back in the day, there was lots of racism and everything else. And I'd find myself getting behind Leeds and, yeah, Vinny, Vinny, Vinny. And all of a sudden, you know, there'd be some racist comments. And I'm thinking, dear me, is this the place for me?
And how did you react to that?
Oh, you know something? I didn't know. I really didn't know, because there I was supporting the team that I loved. It was Leeds. I'm passionate about, you know, Leeds, about Yorkshire. And all of a sudden, one minute you feel so part of something and you're just cheering the guys on. The next minute, you feel like you shouldn't be there. So there was a bit of a conflict when it came to supporting football. But at the same time, you know, I started my rugby career, and one of the things we had through the club was we got to be the ball boy at Leeds. So at a very young age, I can remember throwing the ball on to Gary Schofield. He ended up being sort of one of my heroes, because his mother used to be the tea lady at my amateur club. So every time anybody came in, whether you were, you know, playing for the club or, you know, a visiting team, she would always talk about our Gary. It was always, everything was about our Gary. And she was just a proud mother, because he was one of the biggest players for Leeds and Great Britain at the time.
So you were a young lad and your teams were Leeds United and the Leeds Rhinos. That was those were the team, your local teams that you supported?
Oh yeah. I'm,
and still do?
I wanted to play for Leeds. It was no doubt about it. I wanted to play for Leeds. And I always remember going for a trial. And I came up against a young lad, Gareth Stevens, and his dad was a scout for Leeds. So went for a trial. I didn't get it. You know, we went in there and I don't know, after being the ball boy for it, I lived and breathed Leeds. And I just thought this would be my ultimate dream, to play for my hometown. And I got so close. And then, you know, they said, look, we've signed him. And I was, at the time, I was absolutely devastated.
And that was your first real sporting rejection, presumably.
Oh, massive.
And were you surprised? Had you been cocky? Had you played badly? Or had they just made a decision that they probably, came to regret?
You know something, at the time, there was a few people there. And, you know, they weren't very complimentary towards me, and said I would never make it as a rugby player. I won't tell you the rest of what they said. But it was almost as soon as I got that rejection, I'd been brought up council estates. I had a lot of trials, a lot of challenges in life. So whilst this was a bit of a challenge, you know, and I had that rejection, I knew there was potentially something else. So I was disappointed that I wasn't going to be playing for Leeds. But within no time, I had a call from Wigan Rugby League, and, you know, they invited me over the Pennines, which was very difficult. Yeah. I must add, because I'm Yorkshire, you know, to the core. But I went over in the early 90s. I signed as a 16-year-old. And it was always funny, Giles, because I left school at 15. No qualifications. I think I got 2 E's and 2 F's.
You passed with ease, in fact.
Dear me. So I couldn't wait to get out of school. And if there's one thing I picked up as a young lad, was to work hard. So I was brought up by my mother, 3 cleaning jobs, worked like anything to support me and my 2 older brothers. And as soon as I left school, it was almost to the day, she marched me to the local shop. Back in the day, the shops had the notice boards and you would look at jobs and, you know, things for sale. And she looked at the notice board and she said, right, there's a job for you. And I came straight out of school. The following day, I went for an interview at Ultrasonic Cleaning Services. So where we sort of degreased metal, we got all metal parts from the textile industry and stuff like that. So as a 15-year-old, that's what I'm doing. But it was work. I was when I get my first wage, 50 quid.
And it's money. It's your money.
And it's money. Yeah. And it's money. And, you know, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I wanted to play rugby. And then within no time, I then signed for Wigan. So all of a sudden, I'm working. I'm going in early. So I'm starting probably at 7, finishing at about 3:30, 4, getting in the car. And then going to Wigan, somebody was taking me over there, and then I'd train at Wigan and I'd come back and I'd do that. But all of a sudden, probably took about 6 months. I was only working for about 6 to 8 months. And then I started to progress and they said, look, we want you to come over here full time. So I then moved from Leeds, you know, always living with my mum, two brothers. All of a sudden now I've gone over to Wigan. And, you know,
age 17 years old.
Yeah, so I've been brought up in council estates all my life. You know, we'd never owned anything. All of a sudden I've gone over there and I've got my first house. I've got my first terraced house. I remember it was in Lamb Street, 16 Lamb Street in Welly. It was called Welly, Wigan. And you know something, in many ways it was such a proud moment because I can't remember one person ever in my family that ever owned a house.
Wow. So that was your moment.
And I'm just thinking of that now. I don't know anybody that ever owned the house. And at 17, I had my first mortgage. And I look back now and think, that in itself was a massive achievement, never mind playing rugby. So 17, here I am, Wigan, I go over there.
Let's go back to fans, right? So you're a Leeds man, both for rugby league and for football, and you've crossed the Pennines, so you're now a traitor, I would imagine, in Lancashire, to yourself, let alone to the fans.
Yeah.
And you're not tall now, but you were probably small and not that chunky either. So you're a streak of piss.
Yeah.
You're from Leeds. How on earth did the Wigan fans greet you?
I actually got... I mean, they loved it. Wigan was, and still is, a huge rugby town. I mean, when it comes to fans, you know, the best in the business. I remember playing and there'd be 30,000 people there. They would be there 3 hours before kickoff. They would get their spot. You would see the same people in the same places every week.
And where did that come from? Do you know what, within the history of Wigan, and it's a mighty tradition of as a rugby league club, Is it the greatest of the fan clubs in rugby league in the United Kingdom? Is that what it's always been known for? Is that historical? Or is it something that evolved during the great years that you played for them?
Well, I think Wigan had most of the best players. You know, when it came to professionalism, they were the most advanced in so many different areas. But when you go back and, you know, you look at the names all the way back to, you know, the famous Billy Boston. I mean... they've been spoiled over the years. They've had the world's best there and they've made the most of it. You know, Wigan, up until recently, was only ever known as a rugby town. You know, so they would make sure that, you know, that was the best place to go. Every weekend, get down to Central Park. I mean, just Central Park itself, for fans, it was one of the old stadiums and did get knocked down. You know, probably 20 years ago, but it was just...
there was a shrine, wasn't it? I went on a couple of times and it was an extraordinary experience. Yeah,
yeah, just
the ghosts were there.
The atmosphere, just arriving at the stadium and just the crowd build-up. You know you're at a great sporting arena event when, you know, you turn up way before. People are not just coming and getting in there half an hour before it starts just so they see the game. They want to soak up the atmosphere. They want to see the players coming out and warming up because they know where they are and they kind of sit there and they will have a bit of a rapport with you know, players.
And would they give players jip and tease them? Would there be a good between the town and the community and the players, who many of whom they would have known, of course, because they grew up there? Was there very much that interaction and great humour? Great humour, I imagine.
What is sport without fans?
Yeah.
What is it? I mean, I love rugby and would play it for no money at all. But whether it's five people watching you or 50,000, the fact that somebody else is watching you makes sport what it is. I couldn't imagine sport, you know, just being shown on TV without people in the stadium. It just wouldn't exist. It wouldn't get you going as a player.
And I think every listener would understand that. You know, we have children, and whether you go to a school game and watch your kids, I remember as a deeply poor rugby player if my parents came to watch, it mattered.
Yeah.
Now you amplify that in the sense of the town that you're living in. You've got the responsibility to the club, but also to that community. It must be unbelievably, as a player, to know that the fans, particularly knowledgeable fans who are, it's in their blood, must have made you play always to the very best that you could try to in your form, I would imagine.
Oh, definitely now. And even 20, I left Wigan 20 years ago. And when I go back to the games, I still recognise a lot of the fans.
So you make a transition. I mean, I find that fascinating because you make the big transition over to Rugby Union, and it was, you know, it's all been well documented. But one of the things that's often thrown at English rugby fans, which is obviously the middle class game, Rugby Union I'm talking about, that Twickenham is maybe a fortress, but it's not maybe the most soulful of stadium. And you're thrown into the deep end of playing for your country again, but in front of a lot of wax jackets and...
There's a lot of wax jackets, barber jackets. And
singing really only one song, as far as I can see, and a strange choice at that. That must have been, given that Wigan was, during the 90s when you were playing, it may have been a club side, but it was pretty international in terms of it was celebrated in the BBC. I was a Rugby Union man, but I knew all about it was on television. You won everything going from Challenge Cups to Super Leagues and all the rest of it. To go to a fan environment like Twickenham must have been an adjustment for you.
Yeah, it was a massive adjustment. And I if I'm honest, I didn't really hang around any posh people until I went to Rugby Union. Because even now I still see myself as working class. You know, it's just probably a mindset. But all of a sudden I find myself in this world, and it was difficult.
Did you feel like that little boy when you talk about Leeds United and... There you are, you're with your mates and Leeds are playing, Vinnie Jones is playing, and then suddenly racist chants happen, and suddenly, did you feel that suddenly you sort of half didn't belong in this environment?
Yeah, and you know, I always remember sat in a changing room, and this was when I had a little stint for Bath, but I always remember looking through the programme, and quite often you read the player profiles and it's Phil de Glanville, educated at Oxford. You know, Tarquin something, educated at Cambridge. And then
there's probably a Giles in there if you looked.
There's definitely a Giles. I think he was captain.
Quite right.
And then it came to me, and it was Jason Robinson, educated at Matthew Murray High School, Leeds. And you know something, at the time, I kind of felt a little bit inferior. And probably that I didn't belong, and I wasn't good enough in a certain way. And I think what's great about sport is you can go anywhere, you can belong anywhere. And I realised that when I was later stood at the side of the pitch at Twickenham, coming on for my debut against Italy, I never knew what the fans would be like. Rugby league fans are, they're almost like football fans. They're tribal, they'll get stuck into you, they will rip you to bits. And then making the switch, I had a lot of people that didn't want me to succeed, I knew that, but I knew there'd be some that did, but I didn't realise just how many would get behind me. And I always remember stood at the side of the pitch, and it's against Italy, probably last 20 minutes of the game, and all I could hear was the crowd saying, get him on, get Robinson on, get... And all of a sudden, it was probably at that moment, I thought, you know something, I kind of warmed to it even more because I just didn't know what to expect. And all of a sudden, I just heard all these voices. And when I went on the field, I didn't get many touches of the ball. But when I got the ball, I was beating eight, nine people and probably making 2 metres. I was all over the place. I was like Tasmanian devil. I was just, but it was almost like an acceptance. They accepted me because I was from Rugby League. The history of Rugby League and Rugby Union, they didn't like each other.
And were you one of the very first? I mean, obviously there have been players over the years in Wales, very much more with rugby union players like Jonathan Davis going north. Were you one of the very most high-profile players who'd come from league to union into the RFU, into the Rugby Football Union?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
So this was a real... You'd crossed a Rubicon twice in your career. You'd crossed the Pennines to go from Leeds to Wigan. And then you've crossed coming down south, inverted commas, to come to Fortress Twickenham, which is a different preserve from your own upbringing. Big moment for you.
Yeah, it was a massive moment because, you know, as we've seen both ways, just because you've been good at one sport doesn't mean to say you'll be good at another. And there's one thing for sure is if you do make the transition either way, there will be, you know, there'll be a lot of people just waiting and baying for blood. I always remember my first game, just I knew I had to all of a sudden change some of the things that I'd learned in rugby union. All of a sudden I go from keeping hold of the ball to releasing the ball. I was told about these rucks and mauls, but I didn't understand it until I got tackled. Rugby league is tough, it's physical, but there was nothing. I've never experienced anything like being under the bottom of 12 people that really want to hurt you. They know it's probably the only time they're going to get you in the game, but when they get you, they're going to make it count. So I knew at that moment in time, you know, I had to learn quickly. But what I did bring was a style of play, and I stuck to what I was good at. And obviously things started to go really, really well.
So how many caps did you get for England rugby, for the rugby union team?
So I got 51.
51.
For England.
Amazing. So,
and I only played for 5 years.
I know.
I had 4 years on, retired for a year.
And as a Welshman, it was painful. But when did you feel, in terms of that acceptance from the fans, you know, you've got the traditional Twickenham audience, you said right from the get-go when you made your debut against Italy and people are saying, you know, come on, Jason, and it was very high profile, the media had written a lot about you, and you'd played in front of a national audience on the BBC. People knew about your feet and your pace because we'd all seen it. But when do you feel that you felt accepted by rugby union in all senses, where you didn't feel, well, I can let my feet do the talking, but I'm still an outsider? Was there a moment where you felt, I, Jason Robinson, belong equally with Wigan or with the Rugby Football Union and the England rugby team and obviously Sale and the various teams you played for? But was there a moment when this is now part of me?
Yeah, I think that came probably about four months after making my debut for England. And that was then on the Lions tour. So I'd come into England, you know, I played 3 games off the bench, but I still hadn't started. And things had gone well for me, even though I hadn't scored loads of tries and done all that. But 4 months later, I then get a call for the Lions, the British and Irish Lions. Now, I'd been a Lion in rugby league, but all of a sudden, there I was in this squad. I always remember I was fixing a dog kennel at the time when I got the call. When I got the call up, I had a Great Dane. Imagine that, a little 5'8" fellow with it. My Great Dane was somewhat bigger than me. But I always remember coming in from that and being told, "Look, you've been selected on this Lions tour." And then all of a sudden, I go out on the Lions. People say, "Well, he'd probably come on for the last 20 minutes if that first game score 5 tries." All of a sudden, I'm in the groove and I'm building up confidence. But I think in that Lions tour, playing in all 3 tests, being a starter in it, I think once I came back from that and having my first season in rugby union, I then thought, yes, I now feel fully accepted because I've proven to the England supporters, I've proven to the Lions supporters. And if you remember as well, I played 60 games in that year, 35 in rugby league. I made the switch. I'm playing for England Rugby Union. I go on a Lions tour. I finished my 60 games on a Lions tour. Now, you know how much that takes out of you. Yeah. But I was buzzing. And that was, you know, we talk about fans. Lions, I've been on a Lions tour in rugby league. I wasn't expecting to see what I saw in Australia in 2001.
Would you say that Lions fans reminded you of Wigan fans in a sense?
Unbelievable. I mean, the fact that four nations come together as one team, you know, there's something so special about that. But the Lions fans, they've been saving for 4 years. This is the biggest thing in their life, you know. And I'll never forget being picked for the first game and coming downstairs. You have your team meeting and you come down the stairs and you go out to the coach. And there's just hundreds, thousands of people just shouting, Lions, Lions. And you're just coming through the hotel. You've not even got to the stadium. The atmosphere around the Lions, especially in 2001, was probably the best atmosphere I've ever had. And not just in a, you know, in a stadium, but just all around sports, walking down the road. People that would normally probably give you abuse, the Welsh, the Irish, the Scots, all of a sudden,
you're one of them.
You belong. It's just an amazing experience. And as a fan, I'm, you know, as a player and now sort of a fan of something like that, it's just, I can't tell you how special it feels, you know, to be part of something like that.
That's amazing. I want to go on to some non-rugby questions as we pile through. You've probably been lucky over the years to go to quite a lot of sporting events. Is there a sporting event on your bucket list that you've never been to that you'd love to go to? And there may be someone out there who might let you go. I have no idea. I doubt it. You've been retired a long time. But is there something that you'd love to, a sporting event that you'd love to go to?
Yeah, I've got quite a few. And this is the thing. When you're in it, when you're playing sport, you get so many invites. Oh, do you want to come back? And you can never go.
Yeah, of course, because you're busy doing your day.
As soon as you finish, I don't get any invites. But yeah, I mean, there's quite a few. So my bucket list at the moment would be Super Bowl. I've got to get out to America and see a Super Bowl. I see it on TV.
Looks amazing, doesn't it? I've not been either, yeah. So maybe we could go as a couple.
And I must admit, and I'm saying Super Bowl, I've never watched an American football game all the way through. But I always remember going back to my Wigan days and John Mooney, the coach, used to have all these clips of American football. And they used to show them as a bit of a motivation for the team. And it was just so inspiring just seeing them just cut through all these different players. And I just think as a fan, going there and having that experience, I just think it would be unbelievable. That's one of them.
Okay. You'll add three.
Three. Okay. The other one would be Formula One, Monaco. I'm saving up.
Do you want to be on a boat as well?
Oh, I want to do that.
You want to do that?
I want the full hog. I want to go. I want to go hard on it.
Charlie. Yeah, well, I think you're going to do it in style.
There's no point going there and sitting there standing.
Don't be half-cocked, no.
Yeah, okay. I want a huge, huge yacht.
Okay.
Like that big.
Again, I'm
about half a mile from the track. F1, just, I mean.
All right, we've got that. And then what's your third?
My third, I think it would have to be basketball.
In the US?
I think it's got to be in the US. Yeah, definitely.
Do you have a team, in a particular team
no,
that you follow?
No, no.
Just the whole experience?
When you see some of the greats, you just think, I'd just love to go and do it. You know,
did you play basketball much as a kid? Did you get the chance? No, I know you're very short. No, I know, but if you'd had a stepladder, but what I mean is you'd have whizzed around literally the court, and there are small basketball players who sort of do the hard yards, aren't there?
No, but
it's not my game, obviously.
No,
I'm slightly struggling.
I played him sort of messing about with my mates, but I always remember as a bit of a fan, what attracted me with basketball was the Harlem Globetrotters. Mm. You know, just because, I mean, the skills, yes, they were all 8 foot, you know, 8 foot nine, but the skills, what they could do, you know, with a basketball, just the slam dunks, the tricks, everything else. And, you know, it just captivated me as a fan, even though I don't have a basketball team. I've never been to a basketball game, but I just I love sport played at such a level where even if you don't understand the sport,
you just
marvel at the skill and the amazing athletes on show.
Well, and I agree with you. I think as a relatively tall person, but I'm only 6'4", that makes me tiny. But you're right, though, to watch basketball, big men with the skills and the pace, and they've got skills that you would have, but are literally a foot and a half taller than you. It is astonishing. So, okay, that's interesting. Have you met either a sporting hero that you've met that you're very chuffed that you have met, who, you know, in your career, that someone you came across, or is there someone that you'd love to meet in sport as a fan that you've not met?
Yes. One of them for me growing up was a guy called Ellery Hanley. Now, he was a Wigan player. He played for his country. He was almost ahead of his time in everything, professionalism. You know, he was strong, he was quick, he was skillful, he was tough. He was from Yorkshire and he was black. So for me, you know, growing up as a young black lad, I could identify with it. So seeing somebody like him, you know, dominate just kind of made me feel, well, there might be an opportunity for me. And, you know, I've met him.
Did you play with him?
I never got to play with him. When I joined Wigan, he then went to Leeds. So I played against him, and a very, very tough opponent.
One of the greats, they say.
Oh, without a doubt.
In any code, he could have played just any sport virtually.
And you see him now, and he still looks like he could play.
Really?
Very fit, yeah. Just amazing. But one of those where, whilst I haven't had a lot of opportunities to really sit down and talk to him and just, you know, ask him some questions and spend some real good time with him, it's one of those people that when you're in his presence,
you know.
Just know he's just, you know, people are listening to him, you know, as opposed to just wanting to talk to him. When you're in the presence of those people, it's just a case
of listen. Just listen.
You know, because you know there's nuggets coming out there. You know you're going to learn. You know he's got the experiences that... I've had some amazing experiences, but for him, for me, he was certainly one of those players. And one that I would love to meet that unfortunately has passed away is Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, who is iconic on every level.
Oh, just, yeah. I mean, where do you start?
Well, it's funny. You and I are similar ages. And I think because we caught him as young boys at the end of his career, but he was doing a lot of advertising and doing a lot of chat shows on Michael Parkinson's shows in here in the UK. And one of the things that came over about him was that he had just the most wonderful sense of humour and humanity, as well as being, and I'm no boxing fan, but you only have to watch even the old black and white footage. This guy was the real deal. He could punch going backwards. He was he fought like a lightweight as a 6'3" big fella, but with charm and I think he was voted the sportsman of the millennium or the century, I think, by the BBC in 2000, because what he did as well in terms of overturning and starting on racial barriers and stuff is extraordinary.
Yeah, just an outstanding individual, and you know, from a fan's point of view, you want to see characters. You know, when they speak, you don't want the usual answers. You know, you can answer stuff as a sportsman and be very bland and just say what, you know, you think people need to hear. With him, when he spoke, you saw his character. You know, and
the eyes, they always twinkled.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. He set a place alight. You were waiting for the ring walk. You were waiting for any media around it, because he would create something. You know, those interviews that he did, I mean, just legendary. You know, I'm the greatest.
Yeah,
and I'm not going to get embarrassed about it.
And he's not Mourinho. He really was the greatest.
I am the greatest. You know, just
and he couldn't argue with it. Right, this section is going to be, I'm calling the captain's broadside, so I don't want you to think about it too much. I'm just going to fire some questions at you that some of your fans, if you've got any left, may know about you or may not. And we'll just go through them quickly and see how we go. So what is your favourite sporting stadium to watch sport? Watch it.
That would have to be Wembley.
Okay.
I think going down there as a youngster, experiencing that, and then walking out the tunnel, the history. Oh, yeah, Wembley all day.
And when was the last time you cried watching sport?
Last Sunday.
And that was?
So I went to the testimonial game of Jamie Jones-Buchanan, a guy that has played, I think, 22 years for Leeds. But not only that, there was a young guy, Rob Burrows, who has been a great servant to Leeds, but now has Montenegro's disease. So, you know, he's just been diagnosed with that. And it was kind of a celebration of careers, but also to show him that, you know, the rugby world is fully behind him in the battle that he's now facing. And, you know, I was stood there, and even though, you know, I've never played for Leeds, just to see all these ex-players come from all the different clubs to show their support for, you know, for a family man, for an ex-player, you know, three young kids. When he came on the field, I think quite a few of them came on for the last 10 minutes. But as soon as he came on, I just welled up. I'm a father, you know, I've played the game, you know, and my health is intact. And all of a sudden, here's this young man. And I know what it's like to be a small guy in a tough sport. You know, people don't realise how much more you have to give just to survive. And he was one of those. Some of the tries he scored.
He was a scrapper, wasn't he?
Oh, you know, he used to get battered, but he'd get back up and he'd keep going. And then just to see this horrible disease, you know, him being diagnosed and how it's affected him, you know, just made me cry, because it's just sad. It's just sad.
And but crying, but also a great sense, I would imagine, of fan solidarity, showing human respect, which is also very uplifting all at the same time. It's sad, but also I saw the footage. This was a family of rugby league supporting one of their warriors.
Yeah, and that's how it should be. You know, and I'd like to think, you know, if it was me, you know, people would come out the woodwork and just say, look, we know you're going through some tough times, but we're here for you. And that was the respect that they got and they deserved. And Rob, because, you know, yes, he was a great rugby player. There's no doubt about that. But you know something? He's a nice guy. And people forget, behind the sport, behind the medals, there's actually human beings with personalities, with families. And he is, you know, he's just, every time I've met him, he's just been a nice, down-to-earth guy. And, you know, it's just great seeing the fans coming in to support him and just give him that encouragement that he so needs at this moment in his life.
Oh, it's a great story. And we've seen the same with Doddy Weir in rugby union, and you've seen this extraordinary solidarity, I think, that sports have. You may not be able to sing it if it's a Leeds United song, but do you have a favourite fan song or fan anthem that you remember? Don't tell me it's Swing Low, because that will be the end of the interview.
No, Swing Low is probably not on the radar for me. I mean, I do know all the Leeds, you know, lots marching on together. I mean, it's what I grew up, it's bizarre because I grew up singing it, and I found myself last Sunday at a Leeds game knowing all the words to it and just singing along. But I do actually like Bread of Heaven.
Good man. It is.
And that's not because you're sat there.
No, I know.
Captain, but I do like Bread of Heaven, especially sung in the Principality Stadium.
You're a good man. What's your favourite food at a sports event? Gil, I know you're still an athlete, you're in quite good shape, but what would you have, you know, what's your tipple if you're going to the van behind the ground?
Well, there's only one thing. Wigan, pies. It's as simple as that.
And what's the filling?
Meat and prater. meat and potato.
Yeah.
But yeah, just Wigan pies every day. And if
you want, it's a hot pie.
Oh, it's a hot pie. But yeah, if you want to jazz it up, you put it in a bread cake. or a bomb cake, whichever you call it.
That's jazzing it up.
Yeah, that's jazzing it up with a bit of sauce.
So my next question is, we're on a pirate ship. It's the Reef Gauche. We're sailing along. But you get to choose destination, and it can be landlocked. I mean, it's a metaphor. Where could we take you? Where's your favourite place on Earth?
I think we'd have to go around the Caribbean.
Okay, we can do that. That's actually great, because as a pirate ship, we've got plenty of treasure. And we're at this beautiful table, and we're going to feed you, of course, on the trip to the Caribbean. What would very quickly your three-course meal be? And we're chucking in cheese as a course on me, so you don't have to have cheese as a course. But starter, main, pudding. Quick, go.
Okay, it's probably not going to go together.
It's all right, we're drinking rum with it. Nothing's working.
This will not go together. This will be the worst three-course meal. I want a seafood starter.
Yeah. Oh, we've got that because we've got fishing rods, so you can have as much as you like.
So I have a seafood starter. I want curry goat, rice and peas.
Right.
For the main course, I'm half Jamaican, half Scottish, but I definitely want my curry goat, rice and peas.
Okay.
And then for dessert, I am going to go for sticky toffee pudding.
That is yours. We've also given you a beautiful ensuite cabin on the Reef Gauche. What song would you sing in the shower?
There's only one song, isn't there? Lionel Richie. Truly. I mean, if you're going to sing a song in the shower, it's got to be Lionel Richie. Mm-hmm. And my pick out of his collection would be Truly.
We'll have that on the stereo for you as well.
And I sing it quite often. And sometimes when I'm in the car, I have to turn Lionel down because he's not quite as good as me.
We'll let him know if I can. I don't know how to get to Lionel Richie, but I'm sure there's a way. Do you have a hidden talent, or did you? I mean, like juggling or sort of, I don't know, something that no one would know about you, that something that you can do that people wouldn't even, you know, not sporty particularly.
Giles, outside of rugby, I have no talents whatsoever. All that I have, and it's not even a talent, is a very wide tongue.
That's a talent. That could serve you very well. Perhaps it has. What was the first album you... He's now showing it to me, and it's very wide. What was the first album you ever bought? Do you remember?
I was influenced by my older brothers. And if I remember rightly, it was Spandau Ballet. My brother used to always play Spandau Ballet. So it was a bit of a hand-me-down.
Yeah. But it was an album and it was yours.
It was mine. Spandau Ballet. Gold. That's classic.
It's a classic. And there are a few people we both know who would love to sing that along. And the final question is, if you could smuggle your most valuable piece of treasure on board, because it's a pirate ship and we're smugglers, obviously, what is your most valuable piece of treasure? And it can either be people, it can be a thing. Is there something that you'd like to take with you that we can bury in a chest? If it's personal, obviously it's a bit harsh. But okay, we'll change this. This is our first episode ever. It is not a human. It isn't a dog. It isn't a cat. So it's probably something that is an inanimate object. Is there something that you would like to bring with you? We'll smuggle it down and bury it in the Caribbean so it's safe forever.
I think it would have to be my honours, I think. So I have an MBE and an OBE. No GCSEs, but I have an MBE and an OBE. And for a young lad from Leeds, mother was a cleaner, never knew his father, to then be honoured by the Queen in such a way, I think is something that I'm very proud of.
We'll definitely bring those along, and we'll definitely put them in the most secure treasure chest that we can find. Jason, it's been a huge pleasure to have you as not just my guest, but my first ever guest around the captain's table. Thank you so much for coming on board.
An absolutely pleasure, Captain.